Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, special guest host Dr. Johnny Rees, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, we speak to the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. I am here today with Josh Bryant of Jailhouse Strong. Josh, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
Hey, great. I'm excited to do this one. Looks like you have some good material, Johnny, so look forward to conversing here.
Awesome. Well, I'd like to dig in straight away with idea of being gas station ready. So tell me, I love that philosophy, but in a nutshell, tell me what that means and how you get gas station ready is the second.
Gas station ready is being physically prepared for any situation you encounter. So it's basically physical readiness and not just like in a sense of powerlifting, bodybuilding, or anything else. Because like for example, if you have to foam roll for 3 hours to be able to throw a punch, that's not gas station ready. Gas station ready, we'll be gas station 3 a.m. You're pumping gas, some drunk hooligan comes up, wants your money, your ride, your lady. Are you ready to defend yourself and what's yours? So gas station ready could mean simply just having the build. If if the guy pulls up the gas pump and you're pumping and he sees this Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle back, odds are you're good enough, right? They're probably gonna go away. But if not, then you might have to handle yourself. So I think that's a good metaphor for, but it's really being prepared for anything. So we have another one we call is Waffle House. Right? Have you heard that one? Well, so Waffle House, I don't know if most people listening in the UK are here, but just Google it. They'll be able to explain it. Everything's come up like fighting, craziness. They literally will have drunk people in there. You could walk in there to be like a exotic dancing going on tables with syrup accidentally. It was just a crazy place, right? But that's the same concept. The other one that was interesting about that is Waffle House is open 24/7. So I like that analogy too of are you ready 24/7? So the gas station ready could really be for anything. It's what's it mean to you? But I would define it as those are an easy way to explain to somebody that doesn't know it. But physical readiness for any situation you may encounter. So majority of your situations you're going to encounter, you're going to be highly prepared for and victorious. So it can't be just I'm, able to, squat 1,000 pounds. But if I have to wrap my knees to sit down and take a crap kind of thing, but it can't be, I run, 10,000 meters in 10 minutes, but then I can't do a push-up either. So it's almost like tactical training, but it's basically physical readiness for any situation you encounter.
I love that. And I think that's a great training philosophy as well, because as you said, it's not any one quality is developed, but nothing's neglected, right? I think that's great. And
it is. I love powerlifting. I love bodybuilding. I think it's a lot of people would know me from that kind of stuff. And I still embrace it and all that. So I think there's definitely a time and a place for that. I just think when you're not specifically preparing for a competition, or you're kind of getting out of that phase, or you might be in this phase, getting to that, but it's not against that so much, because there's a difference between approaching something with a competition mindset, because I still think you need a baseline of aerobic conditioning even for strength, just to help with regeneration, recovery, all that stuff, right? Between sets, between sessions, yada, yada, yada kind of thing. But, there's a difference between being able to do a baseline level of those activities versus pushing to the next level. So I think that's where it gets different. If you're competing, you definitely are making some sacrifices in those other qualities if you want to be best. And that's a given. And that's fine. And that's what you should do if you want to actually do something with it. Now, if it's just a sideline hobby and not something really important, you just sort of a way to test your strength, that's fine too. Then you don't have to be as, aware of that.
So I have a new goal that I'm kind of stealing from you, but this idea of 50 cubed, right? So I'll let you explain it, but it kind of feeds into the gas station mentality. It's kind of relevant to it as well, right?
So 50 cubed basically means, it goes back to the work with, obviously the Tom Havlin would be the gold standard of 50 cubed. It's like, you know, everybody else is fighting scraps for second place. But, you know, but that's the idea, is be able to move like you're 50 pounds lighter, be able to, you know, have this and have the movement capacity of somebody of 50 pounds lighter, the agility of somebody 50 pounds lighter, the speed, all that stuff, but then the strength and power of somebody 50 pounds heavier. So cube becomes exponential. You know what I mean? It's like fit. So it's like 50 times 50 times 50 is not 50 plus 50 plus 50. I think that's real life, is like when you can develop all that stuff, you're exponentially better at a multitude of different things. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's almost like the, you know, a compounding effect. If you keep doing all these little things and like put it together, it's a pretty magical thing. And that's the idea right there, is to be proficient in all those things. And that's what we're actually working on, you know, with Tom right now, is the Operation 320. We're going to start that up officially here pretty soon after it gets down to 280. But anyways, that's the idea, because before we had a little bit of a, I'd say a little bit, I don't think it was too much of them, but there's definitely to a strength bias, like push those numbers. So over, like an example I give on this is, so I don't, you're probably not familiar with it, but there's a trail, it's called the Manitou Incline. It's in Colorado. And so it's already at elevation pretty high, and you guys should look it up if you've seen it, but it's not long. It's like, you know, for a mile or something, or, you know, kilometer and a half, whatever. But it's like 3,200 steps or something. It's like literally straight up. Like, it could be dangerous walking down it, kind of thing. Like, you know what I mean? So, but the point being, we just hiked that a couple weeks ago. And you have to look at, like, there's not a lot of really big people doing that. So not even like muscular people, like people just, I mean, just mass is going to hold you back to a degree. I mean, I saw that hiking up the Great Wall of China, which is not quite, it's not nearly as hard. That's easier. But you'd see people who are bigger try to do it, and they would just be kind of sidelined. So there's that part too. So I think we were a little, so for overall, say end of the world, shit, it's a fan, whatever you want to call it, you know, we were a little definitely to the strength. But I do think a lot of people bias it the other way, because, oh, you know, a lot of, you know, a lot, like 20 years ago, people complained about all the tests were like too aerobic bias and all that for like law enforcement, military and all that. And I think a lot of them still are. And that's so, because the reality is, you know, there's a guy named Harry Walker I work with. He's a Green Beret, wildland firefighter. And he will actually be willing to sacrifice a little bit for the metric. He always passes the conditioning tests with flying color, but he had like the perfect score because he's going to keep a little extra mass on, because it's like one of those things of like, you know, like if you're in a real life situation, like having an extra 25 pounds of muscle might be able to, like, you know, plow something down or whatever you may need to do, where, you know, being like, you know, even if you're 270 and you're shredded, I mean, unless you're like Tom's height, it's not going to really probably pan out well on the endurance side of things. Where, because it's amazing, you know, when you put this all together, how fast you can be when you're big. If you get really strong, it's not going to, you know, the sacrifice is going to be in your deceleration, your agility, things like that. But if you just want to like move straight ahead, it's pretty impressive what you can do. So we're trying to put this together of a truly balanced approach of like not making one of those qualities a sacrificial lamb, like keep it in balance and keep it true, but then be able to come over, he'll come over to the United States here and hit some, you know, some big numbers after all of this, but make it a true thing, because that's what we're trying to do with that. And with this is not the problem people have. And I've made this mistake. I've made this mistake with people I work with. Everybody's made this mistake, or is overvaluing short-term readiness. You know what I mean? Like, that's what's cool about being able to work with like my kids, like, I don't mean like random kids, my own kids. It's just being able to see that and teach them that of like, you know, we're not going to overvalue physical readiness of like, you know, you're going to go to a tryout or something. I know you're going to make it, you know? And so if you're like, you know, not quite 100%, you know, I tell them like, we're going to work out today, but now, you know what? You know, you're second fastest out of the fastest out of 100 kids. Okay. Well, you know, now you are the fastest, just because we build that up over time, where that work capacity is so high, it doesn't really matter anymore. But just when you think it doesn't affect you anymore, if you do have to pull the plug on it because something's really important, you'll be amazed at the kind of like jump you get performance at that point.
And I think a lot of stuff like strength, you'll know a lot about this, but it sticks around for longer. It takes a lot less to maintain it, right, than it does to gain it in the first place. So you can kind of prioritize.
Any of this stuff is, that's where like the block model idea can be helpful, is once you get a quality at a high level, it doesn't take near the amount of volume to maintain that quality. So like you want to run a mile in 6 minutes. You guys have England needs, you know,
except we use miles. Yeah. You're all good.
Yeah. So say you want to get to like a 6 minute mile, a good pace for a non track runner, like a fit person. It's to get there. You might say you're running a 10 minute mile when you start or something. It's going to probably be pretty hard to get there. But once you can get there, you can kind of hang around that level with not near the amount of volume, you know, where just how if you get your deadlift at 500 pounds, you could do it a lot less. Like, you know, I've done that with like myself getting, you know, just get to a decent level, then primarily do strongman stuff. Then like once every month or something, hit a deadlift or something. And it's pretty much right there kind of thing. Where if I want to take it even further up, it's going to require, you know, a more specific systemic approach.
Aside from like friends in the military and stuff, you kind of popularized rucking. Well, for me, certainly, because you literally wrote the book on rucking years ago before it's suddenly a big craze now, right?
Honestly, at first, I didn't even know it was a thing. I used to do it in high school after my legs would be sore after football games and stuff. I'd throw a weighted vest. I mean, I guess it wasn't technically rucking, it was walking with a weighted vest, but we had some big stadiums, throw it on, and I knew if I walked up and down it, at a pace, I wasn't scientific at all, a pace where I'd break a little bit of a sweat, I could carry on a conversation with somebody, probably not give a speech, but like I could carry it on with, like, you know, I got some kind of active recovery out of that. So I've been doing that for a long time. And then, yeah, it looks like it. See, it's funny. I guess it is, because I've seen like, I've wondered that, like, because where I live, I see people rucking all the time. And when I'm rucking, I usually do it alone, or if I'll do it with, you know, one other person. I don't do it like in groups. So I don't talk to the people doing it. So I don't know if they saw me and copying it and like I set a trend, or if it's just a worldwide trend that they don't even know who the hell I am kind of thing. I was wondering that. But I see a lot of people doing it around here.
Yeah, I mean, it suddenly exploded, but I guess it's a way to get this sort of zone two cardio that everybody talks about as well, right? There's restorative in some ways.
It's a good way to get some of that in, and then you can you know, it's relaxing too, because obviously, you know, it doesn't have to be to get some kind of health benefits. It doesn't have to be real intense, but you can certainly push it up to more intense, especially around here, because it gets hotter than hell here. So like even in the morning and stuff, it's pretty hot. Like I did it this morning at like 6 a.m. and it was pretty hot. I mean, I didn't check what the temperature was, but it was pretty dang hot, you know? And I think so, like, it's crazy the kind of boost you get in performance around here when it cools down, because it's weird. You always think you're adapting to it and like thinking it doesn't affect you and like all is good, you're progressing. Then it drops down temperature and you feel like Superman, or you go to like another city, work out in an air conditioned gym or something. It definitely has a little bit of an effect.
I bet. Yeah. It's one of those things that it'll wear you down as well. Right. But it's all part of that being gas station or waffle out ready, that walking for a long period. And then brings me on to my next topic, but walking for a long period.
I think one more thing on that.
Yeah.
The biggest benefit I've noticed for that kind of training from before, because I used to do like a lot. Also, I've gone through periods, I've done the rucking, but then I've gone through periods where I've only done like intervals. And I'd be like, okay, I can do like just as intense as now. The recovery between them was where I noticed the big difference. Not so much doing anything. It's the recovery between sessions and sets. Like, okay, before it's like, okay, I can get going and go really well, but then to get back to down to be able to do it at a reasonable level again, it's going to take a long time, where now it's a lot quicker. That's kind of like the bigger thing I think what people miss is like thinking, okay, I'm going to be able to do this. Not necessarily. What's going to happen is between sets, between sessions, so then you can get more done. That's like what Louis Simmons likes to talk about, raising your work capacity, is like you're going to be able to do more things. So the like, does it directly affect your performance right now? Maybe not. But over the long term, when you recover, you can do more, you get better kind of thing. And layman's is right there.
And that's so applicable across a whole range of applications, right? That's
anything, yeah.
Most of the time, especially with tactical populations and those sorts of people, you end up having to walk for a long period and then sprint, right? So it's not that much of this middle ground. And I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about hill sprints and sprints in general, but hill sprints specifically, and maybe why you'd program those for strong people over flat sprints.
Yeah. So let's first go into the tactical thing. So I don't know if you have a lot of tactical listeners on here. However, we touch on it in case, is it mostly like strength coaches in the audience or more just people?
Mainly strength coaches, personal trainers.
Okay, so yeah. You end up working with somebody probably at some point because us, you guys, Britain, we're definitely some of the stronger armies and they're obviously not all doing it right. So they're going to have to come to you at some point, you know? And so you have to look at it a couple different ways. Are we training to pass a test, or are we training for like gas station ready? We can call it physical readiness. So like, what does the person actually need versus what do you need to do to like get a promotion? Because like they might have to get a 600 on ACFT and advance, whatever it is. And then it becomes about beating a test. Just how like if you're personal training, I remember taking the NSCA test. I knew a lot of stuff was bullshit, but I knew how they wanted to answer it. So, you know, on the nutrition, like 100, didn't miss one question because I put myself in their mind versus like, well, it's actually this, you know, I'm just going to play the game, get it, and then move on kind of thing. And so you have to look at it that way of like a lot of the people, they may need you just to help them beat a test. Sounds like you're cheating, but they may need to help get past the test. Okay. So that's a different conversation. That's going to be, so it could be over here, it could be like a 2 mile run. And that you're not gonna actually encounter that. But for what you're saying is absolutely correct. So like even William J. Kramer from the NSCA and there was saying he called it the anaerobic battlefield now because the stuff is heavy. Some of the stuff, if you go through and read in Rucking Gains and stuff, I don't remember if I put that part in there. Because I don't know how, I didn't want to make it too much about that, but the research, did a lot of research on it. So a ton of research on it on different, there's not a lot of good research on rucking because they're saying it's like, they were saying initially you can do it like once a month or once every 2 weeks. And I got all kinds of people to do it every single day. Cause like, I mean, say you do it with 50 pounds. If you gain 50 pounds, they're gonna tell you can't walk every day. They beg you like a dog to walk every day. So how in the hell is this that much, right? You know? Like just not using common sense. But anyways, a lot of it's going to be really heavy. So they're having over here in the research, I was going to some archives. They were talking about people in Grenada, which is somewhere, I don't know, South America, somewhere, you know, down that direction. And we had some sort of like, you know, conflict there or whatever in the 1980s. Some of the shit was getting so heavy then. There's a story about one guy's weighed 130 pounds. He said, isn't it funny? I guess he lives, so I'm going to joke about it now. But he was saying he'd walk 6 steps and throw himself on the ground. It'd be like a strong person, you know, 800-pound yoke or something. Stop. Breath, you know, stop. And but even in Afghanistan, some of the stuff not averaging about 100 pounds. So the way it feels, we'll say a good fit ruck. Like I have a ruck that's 75 pounds. Doesn't feel bad. In this room, I do the Stairmaster or something. I got a weighted vest that weighs 80. The weighted vest to me feels a hell of a lot heavier. It's 5 pounds because of the way it's just not as comfortable. I have another vest, 120. That thing hurts like hell. You know what I mean? So like a lot of it's that, but like it's going to become a lot of being able to walk, like you're saying, long distances, up hills, then sometimes sprint. You know, that's what it's going to be. The odds of having to jog like a 9 minute mile pace or something, a 10 minute mile pace with that is not super high. It's going to be like so you have to look at it two ways. Obviously, you have the repeatability of sprints, you know, the repeated sprint ability, you know, so there could be like ways to train for that, you know, intervals, things like that, you know, like you could even do stuff like, I forget who the NFL strength coach had a pretty good one. They basically did like 40 yards. And was talking like, you know, 15 sprints and to do one every 45 seconds is about 90% of their max speed because that's the reality of a game. So like that kind of stuff. But anyways, back to your hill sprints. The reason I like it for this population of stronger people is a couple of reasons. One, hills are going to be a limiting factor for a lot of people and a lot of terrain they could be in. Like, you know, whether it's like somebody, like an actual soldier or just somebody hunting or something in the mountain. It could be all sorts of different applications. There's that part of it. then the safety part of it, the turnover is not fast enough that your hamstring tissues are not stressed so bad because it's not, the stride's not quite that long. It's not quite so fast. It slows you down just enough, shortens you just enough that it makes safety. So like if you say you deadlift, you know, 600 pounds, you go in there and you do 540, that's 90% of that. That's still relatively heavy, and probably the risk of injuries, you know, is obviously going to go up a little bit with 600, but not astronomically. Sprinting, you know, 90% to 100%, that's where everything happens. I mean, if you're like decently gas station ready, you should be able to hop in 80, 90% with no warm up. I mean, not like that's the point to do that, but that should be like your readiness should be, okay, I have to take off quickly. I can if I need to. I don't want to actually test that, but just knowing you can. Because I've done that, you know, just doing like tempo runs and things, 75%, and I can just go start them with no warm-up. Not that I'm advising you to do that. I just know I've done it, and it's no big deal. Where the hill sprints are more like that, where like the if you're decently conditioned for this, the risk is fairly low. You know, where flat ground, one of the biggest predictors of your sprint speed is your strength to body weight ratio. And a lot of people listening to this are into strength. So that means you're going to be stronger than normal people. So you have like all this horsepower, but the problem is, you know, it's like a teenager with a real powerful car or something. You just hit the gas and what's going to happen. So you got to work into it. And the hill is going to keep you, you know, more honest and keep you safer.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And especially if they're not accustomed to that kind of the power they can generate on the flat, as you said, if they're not accustomed to it, if you can deadlift 2.5 times your body weight or whatever it might be.
I'll do flat sometimes and just like feel the difference in speed. It's like, okay, especially when you get going. Cause like if you're going to do flat, I would recommend, you know, so about 20 yards and in, so 18 meters and in. Because once you start getting past there is when you open up. So again, most people are going to be okay if they're decently conditioned for this to do those shorter distances. But you start getting towards, you know, because the average person, I should say average, track runners hit their best at about 60 meters top speed, so 66 yards. Most people listening to this are not track runners, so we're going to hit a little bit earlier. So then we got to worry about, you know, you start getting 40, 50 out there. You could have problems, but I think 20 in, you're kind of relegating that to more of like a hill sprint type of a deal. So I would say, you know, one of the things for the repeated ability I've done for that kind of stuff is just sometimes like for conditioning is go for like, you know, go like for 15 minutes or so, you sprint like all out, like a true sprint, 100%, but only for 10 yards and then walk back. So if you're fast, it's going to take you a while to decelerate. Then you walk slow back and keep that up. You get a lot of work in. It feels really good, and it's pretty low risk for conditioning.
And I think it's interesting as well because we're talking about all different qualities here, right? We're talking about strength. We're talking about endurance. We're talking about speed. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was managing recovery over, say, like a week or over a month and how you kind of look at because I know you have some like ways in which you program, for example, that'll help with recovery, especially if people are a bit stronger or maybe a bit older or a combination of both, right? Recovery considerations would be...
I think the number one thing with recovery is, you know, I think for whatever reason, I don't know, I don't remember it always being like this. It seems like people are really heavy and like kind of... biohacking, if you will. Have you noticed that? I don't know. It seems more heavy on it lately than before.
I mean, everybody's got Huberman's latest protocol, right? All that sort of stuff. So
yeah. And like, so like versus like, and let's not even like say this is good or bad. Let's just, the fundamentals the basics are fundamental. So like that comes down to, it doesn't matter if you're like out drinking every night and sleeping 4 hours, like you can't get rid of that with an ice bath kind of thing. You know what I mean? So that's I think the main thing what Fred Hatfield, who mentored me, used to talk about a lot is if people start bringing this, he would yell at seminars and stuff. He'd be like, it's periodization, it's planning, you know, like, and that's what it is. So assuming somebody, you know, is serious about it, we're going to assume they have their lifestyle, you know, dialed in, they're eating, you know, at least some form of like, what could be considered correct nutrition, they're resting, all that stuff. Then then I think then it becomes down to periodization and planning, and all that other stuff is like, you know, pretty far in the distance. And usually when people seem overly concerned about that, they're probably looking for some kind of gimmick or some way out of hard work. It's going to mainly be like modifying your lifestyle, where like, you know, like you think of the psychology behind it. If you're having to like, you know, take an ice bath and, you know, go Instagram live and, you know, have your dog out there scared and all that. I mean, is this necessary? Or are you just trying to like get some attention? I mean, you gotta be honest with yourself. You're trying to OnlyFans or whatever. You probably can do better ways, you know, kind of thing. Like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, it's usually some sort of gimmicky act and like, you know, that kind of thing. So it really comes down to your lifestyle and then like your periodization and your planning. And then just doing things with like, you know, then you go the next thing down the kind of like the pipeline would be doing it, you know, with a safe technique. And you don't have to necessarily, if you're not power, you know, whatever, doing like a technique Nazi. It's not like if you slightly off, you know, in something, you get rid of all the benefits, but doing it in a way that's not putting undue stress on your body. Because like talked about before, for example, if you guys want to see like an explosive deadlifter, go look up a guy named Orlando Green, probably the most explosive deadlifter ever. Watch, slow down the video. You won't believe this. He actually jumps up in the air and like lands and grabs the bar without really hitting the ground. Just comes up, like just yanks it, right? So when he was competing, I figured out with him, initially I tried to work with him like a normal deadlifter. And like, so that was really helpful though, because it didn't really work, except at the end when it's kind of getting injured, like, hey dude, just like chill out. Let's take about a month of everything light, come to meet, hit a PR, like a huge PR, but that's just because of the downtime. And so I figured out with him how much that took to recover, because it was so traumatic on his body. So he handled that a little differently than somebody that's like, say, pulling on a sumo with perfect technique and all that kind of stuff. So you have to look at like the kind of, you know, stress the body's receiving from even the lifter's technique and mind. There's a lot of things to look at, even the mindset. You know, if like we're talking like this and you're so how the hell do these Bulgarians do daily maxes? Because they're kind of almost how we are right here. Then they walk up to the barbell, they don't psych up and they do it. So maxing out how we're talking right here is not gonna be near the same as like, you know, headbutting the wall and sniffing ammonia and all that kind of stuff. So there's that, you know, actually the tactical performance of the lift too, versus just what the lift is. So I think the people that are having success are able to somehow, basically they can look at all this crap somehow and like wrangle it into like a coherent, like kind of evaluation and make something happen, where there's a lot of people that are like really smart that don't seem to get any results with people, because they're not decision makers. They're kind of like, oh, well, you know, what about this? What about this? It's like, but then like it gets so crazy and anal retentive, like no results follow.
It's often the people who need the recovery the least who focus on it the most, I guess.
Oh, dude. Yeah, I noticed that. Like, and there was, another country I was in, there was somebody like that. A guy was, I've had him a few times, he was quoting myself to me. He'd read all my books and quoting all these Russians. And I'm like, this guy is going to, I mean, he looks like decently. He's probably, you know, and like he was built to deadlift and he was normal size man and he couldn't deadlift 315 at the seminar, like pounds, not kilos. It was weird. It was like, dude, like you'd almost be better off with the gym bros calling you a pussy and like challenging. You'd be further along, you know? It's like, cause some people, it like actually like, knowledge is obviously, you know, knowledge is not the issue anymore there, because there's so much information out there. It's like, who can cut through the bullshit or at least like package it into a coherent thought process and execute over and over and making like a compounding effect? Because like, by all means, people are getting the strongest they've ever been, but you have to look at, like, I was talking to Dave Tate off camera before we started, and he was saying there could be a few hundred thousand people in just the U.S. powerlifting. Like, where like before there was like, you know, 10, 15, 20,000, something like that. Not very many. So you know, like that, that, but like, so yeah, the strongest people are much stronger, but on the flip side is like the weakest people are a lot weaker. So like the, and I've noticed that in gyms too, like the average person is not as strong as like, there weren't people that were that weak like in the 80s and 90s. Cause I was, you know, 5 years old sneaking in gyms, the YMCA, cause my dad played racquetball there, and all the old guys there like thought it was cool that I actually wanted to be in there. And like, you know, it was, so I would have, there was not as many like super crazy strong people, but everybody was pretty strong and they all looked like they worked out and stuff. So it's kind of interesting of like, I don't know what it is of like, it's almost like when people, you know, like people, I don't know what it is there, like people nowadays here are going to like these, you know, Harvard, Princeton, and like, you know, the redneck with two teeth is making three times as much money as their doctorate. And it's just, it's almost like you get to a certain point where it, I don't know. It's weird. Never seen anything like it, but it's like you can get, and I don't want to, I provide information and education, all that stuff for a living. So I'm not, obviously not bad mouthing this, but at the end of the day, you got to get in there. You got to get after it. You got to try some stuff. You know, you're going to learn along the way. You know, that's where, I think we're Dave Tate and I were talking about it, is like a good coaching and stuff can help you out because you're going to learn stuff along the way. So that's where, you know, why people like me are in business, because we can kind of help cut through the crap and not make the same mistakes and like have a coherent explanation. Because I was just thinking of Metroflex when I first went there. One of the best bodybuilding trainers there, he got fired from another gym because he didn't have certification and he wouldn't get it. But he'd helped train Ronnie Coleman. And he told the guys, like, you know, I helped build Ronnie Coleman. Like, F you, I'm out of here. And, like, I was, like, thinking, like, in my mind, I'm like, this guy was, like, 50-something years old, like, ripped and, like, a perfect form and everything. I'm like, you're – in my mind, I'm like, you're lucky he's even, like, willing to train people at your sorry-ass gym, let alone try to run them off. And that, you know, that's, like, the mentality. So, you know, I don't know.
It's funny, yeah. The extremes are definitely more extreme, but the average is definitely lower. But then I guess you come in with the extremes, right? The guy's really right, pushing the envelope. But I think I read something that you trained over 20 people who've hit more than a 600-pound bench press.
Yeah, for that, sure more now. I think like 25 or so.
Yeah, that's nuts. For British viewers, you know, 600 pounds is 270
feet. Anywhere. I mean, yeah. Bench pressing is interesting because, one, you're using smaller muscles, so that's going to limit how much weight's lifted. Two, the injuries seem to be more detrimental. So, like, for example, if, like, people, like, get hip replacements, like, 3 weeks later, it's possible. People do that all the time. I don't hear people like, oh, I got a shoulder, you know, replacement, and I just benched my PR, you know, kind of thing, unless they weren't lifting beforehand. Or even like, you know, just tearing a pec. If it's a full-on rupture, you can get surgery to make it look better, but it's odds are there's a good chance it won't execute contraction exactly the same way again. So like you could get to like, you know, a pretty decent weight and rep it out. But then when you get to like the actual max effort, it can get pretty difficult. So that's why I think the bench is tricky of, you know, like you're saying, a lot of people that are so concerned with recovery and stuff are the ones that don't need to be. So you do want to have like that killer instinct, but you can't go all in psychotic because you're in the bench press, you can be one injury away from never benching, you know, to your potential again. Where on a squat or something, it's, you know, you tear a quad or something. I mean, get it fixed up, you're probably going to be back.
Bigger muscles, right? More margin for error, I guess.
I had a guy that, you know, he's about to compete, go for a 661. He did 644. So that was on bench press. His PR, and so his PR before that was 616. He tore his bicep, not lifting. He was moving a refrigerator, and I guess when he was moving it, it like tipped or something, kind of like a freak accident. The 11 months later, he hit that PR. So that's with the surgery, the recovery, getting back to training, building up, and then with 11 months, had a PR, which he considered at that level a good gain for the year period if he didn't ever get hurt. So, but that's kind of, you know, with a bicep, you can come back from that too. But you got to be careful on bench pressing. You get the shoulder problems and you know, ruptures in your pec, you know, too much in your elbows. And that's a fine line too. You like a lot of that stuff. Problem is a lot of stuff that works really well can be dangerous. That's why if you don't know what you're doing, you need to get guidance, because the bad stuff can actually help you short term.
And there are a lot of so one of the things, I think I got this either from you or from Charles, but
okay,
I think when I was going for like a 225 bench press test would be, and I'm sure you got tons of these sort of strength ways in which you can improve strength temporarily, right, was to like do maybe one rep at like 350, rest 5 minutes, or even like 100%. Hold 400, rest 5 minutes, and then kind of go into the 225, right?
Yeah, your central nervous system just becomes more efficient at recruiting the right motor units, and you're off to the races 100%. So that's a good thing for any kind of combine thing, or like over here for the NFL, they have you go there and do 225 for reps. So you don't need to max out. So say you're benching 400. Just throw in 315, do one rep, wait 4 or 5 minutes, and you're gonna do it more times. I mean, it's interesting how people even intuitively will pick that up. Like, I had one of my kids put on a weighted vest, said, just do a pull up, you know, take it off, wait a few minutes. How many pull ups do you do? He's like, I feel like there's nothing there now. And that, so I think people kind of get that. They're like in tune, you know, with their body. And that's what's kind of interesting about, you know, like it is good to have feedback and all this stuff too. But if you get so dependent on different devices, you can never kind of learn at the same time. You can like not really learn your body either. You know what I mean? Cause it's just all off of like, I mean, a machine can tell you whatever, but like, I just know people that have, you know, missed a flight or whatever, drinking all night at the airport, hungover, and somehow, well, do PRs the meet. Like, that's not recommended. I'm just saying, like, had they gone off just like the heart rate variability, they probably would have needed to check into a hospital.
and it brings up another point that different things will, you know, people are going to have different fiber makeup and different things work for different people. So I've heard you talk about, you know, slow gainers and fast gainers, and how, like, for example, a slow gainer might respond better to as many reps as possible set at the end, whereas like a fast gainer who's naturally more explosive would get less out of that, right?
Yeah, so basically a slow gainer is going to need to do more. And I think a lot of them were misled, because there was a lot of people there. There was a study on this, and that actually kind of, I mean, I have it saved here somewhere. It's verified, like, kind of the idea of this, but basically the slow gainers generally need to do more. So there's like a long time, there was a lot of people kind of perpetuating the idea that if you're a slow gainer, you need to do less. And I that doesn't make sense, because any, like, just think of a logic standpoint, anytime you're not naturally as in tune to do something, you usually have to work harder at it. Like, you just do, like, you know, and you might be better off for it in the long run. And but like, there's no way around that. So, and then the other idea is, like we were talking before about sprinting, I was warning you guys, hey, you know what? You have a strong strength body weight ratio. You go out there, you sprint, your tissue's so efficient. If you're not ready for it and you can't tolerate it, you're going to get hurt. It's going to drain you too, you know, more so where if you run a 40-yard dash in 4 or 5, it's to go all out, you're going to feel it. You know, a lot of times, you know, people get mad at, like, you know, like football players and stuff, say, hey, you know what? You're not going as hard as you should in practice and all this. But the thing is, if they actually went 100% sprints all the time, they would never walk, you know, because they'd be doing it so, that's how efficient they are. So those people don't need a lot of volume. Power and speed already doesn't need a ton of volume to get the stimulant, you know, to get the training effect, like, say, building muscle does. But they're going to, like, tax themselves if they did that. Where, like, if you're a slow gainer, then other people say, like, they can't go to failure. It's going to cripple. I don't think that's true, because the people I worked with, they'll go to failure easier because they just don't, they can't, they're not even like in tune with how to use their body and stuff. So like maybe as they advance, but not in the beginning. So they can do like, if they can do more intensity, really, and more volume, you know, like it's the big three things in determine a training effects. You got intensity, you have volume, you have frequency. most sports scientists would probably say they do one of those pretty heavy. The in the trenches observation, a lot of guys do two of those heavy, but those guys can do three of those heavy. You know, all those different variables, like to a higher extent, just because they're not as efficient and they're not causing as much damage to their muscles, or central nervous system, all that stuff.
Yeah, as you said, like if you're bench pressing 200 pounds versus 600 pounds, right? The human body isn't that different. Like 600 pounds, no matter who you are, is going to be more fatiguing, right?
Right. It's in that there again, I like to say, you know, it was what was Dr. Andrew Locke saying one time, like, become the evidence kind of thing. And that's the right. So I'm not trying to be like, study said this, but there was actually, you know, not the, I think you should, the difference is I would say with all this stuff, there are tools at your disposal. Like, so if you're only in the literature, you know, that's probably a problem. If you disregard every single study ever done, that's probably a problem. But it was saying, basically, along the lines of showing how the squatting, as people got stronger, they needed longer rest breaks, like 50%, 70%, all that stuff. It's just like, if you're squatting 1,000 pounds, you know, 700 for 10, if you can do it, is probably going to be a son of a gun, man. They're going to take forever to recover. Where if you're, you know, squatting, you know, 300, doing 210 for 10, you probably could carry on a conversation on speakerphone or something like that. And no one even knows that. I'm exaggerating, but that's kind of the point of it. It's just different. It's going to be harder to recover. Just how, like, you know, you get in better shape sprinting, but you're faster. You might not recover as fast just because you're faster.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess quickly turning to, there's so much I could ask you about training, but quickly turning to kind of mindset stuff. I know that, for example, you've done a lot on this and you actually qualified in like hypnotherapy and NLP and all sorts of stuff. And you mentioned it earlier with the recovery, like how you talk to yourself really matters and having gratitude will really matter.
Absolutely.
I was wondering if you could give us sort of maybe three of your biggest kind of or most impactful tips for managing mindset and for kind of having positive self-talk.
Okay. So I would say managing mindset, the first one is, and I'm so saying, I'm not trying to like talk down and preach to you guys. I'm guilty of these things too, because that's how I know it kind of thing. But as one is manage, you know, manage what you're putting in, you know, garbage in, garbage out. So like, there was one study that showed, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it showed people were 27% more likely to have a bad day if they watched the news in the morning or read the, you know, kind of thing. So you want to be careful what you're putting in. Like, you know, people always say, like, you know, well, don't you want to be informed? You know, I don't know. Maybe you probably do. But like, generally, when you're trying to find information out, you could like find it out, but you don't need to go down a rabbit hole. Secondly, odds are if it's that important, someone's going to tell you anyways. And then if it's that important, you can research it on your own kind of thing already. But I think like staying, basically not putting garbage in, because garbage can come out. Like, even, again, I listen to bad music too all the time when I'm working out. But I've wondered that if like even like music has been shown in studies to have a very hypnotic effect. So I'm wondering, like, you know, because your habits and your thoughts, habits, all that produce like a biochemical reaction in your head, and that becomes addictive. So like, it's almost like, so why do you scroll on your phone when you don't feel good doing it? Like, because you're addicted to it. So it's like, there's something going on that's causing that addiction. Like, why do you, you know, why do people on crack, that's life's destroyed and don't even like the way they feel 5 minutes after, do it because it's an addiction. So it's just, it's not as bad of one, but it's that kind of addiction. So you have to be, you know, mindful of that. So what you put in is really important. How do you be, then also kind of go back to the basics of, you know, all this comes down to your self-talk. Everything is going to come down to your self-image. The self-image is a mental portrait you have of yourself. So the reason is nobody wants to, even really bad people, they don't want to, like, people get caught for like the worst crimes in the world. And when like they're in the cop car, they're always justifying why they did it. Like, nobody wants to think of themselves as a bad person. No one wants to think of themselves as a liar. So you have to work on your self-image, because you're going to behave consistently. with it. So if you have all these thoughts and ideas stored in your subconscious mind, that's where self-talk comes in, because you say something enough times, eventually you're gonna believe it. So if you make jokes about yourself, like, you know, oh, that's, you know, I'm such a damn mess, I always do that. Like, you keep doing that over and over, and eventually you're gonna start to see your subconscious mind. You learn this in hypnotherapy, doesn't really know that, it doesn't have a sense of humor. It takes what you say at face value, you know, and how deep does that go? No one knows for sure, but it can go pretty deep of just things like, you know, like a lot of times people say, like, you know, what's your goal? I don't want to be fat anymore. Here's fat. It would be like, I want to be lean, you know. I don't want to be like last place in this. I want to be last place in it. I want to finish in the top, whatever, you know, I want to do whatever. So the way you, that, like, talking in the positive, and I don't know, but you think about a lot of times when people talk to you and stuff, you just hear that word. So you want to state what you want in the positive instead of, you want to always, that works even with like dealing with people, relationships. You got to always focus on what you can do, not what, you know what I'm saying? So the same concept there. So I think, you know, manage your self-image and realize everything's going to come back to that is your self-image. And you're going to behave consistently with it. So if you don't do a good job building up with self-talk, practicing gratitude and all that stuff, it's not going to be a good thing. So what you can do is just like a book, buy our book called Grounded in Gratitude. It's cheap. It's on Amazon. And we'll actually give you a plan laid out. You can just write it. And if you don't want to do that, just start with something easy. Just write down, you know, 5 to 10 minutes a day. Just write down for 5 minutes a day, just for the next month, either the morning or at night, write down things you're grateful for. And you'd be amazed at what you can come out with. It doesn't have to be like something huge either. It could be like, you know, I'm thankful that you had me on because I connect with new people and have a nice conversation. It doesn't have to always be like, I'm thankful for, like, the, it could be even like, I'm thankful for, I mean, breakfast this morning. A lot of people around the world don't have any food. You know, I'm thankful that I can see you while we're talking. People are blind. You know, you can hear me. All that stuff is, people are always thinking like the one, you know, great thing that happened, but there's so much little stuff. And the thing is, when you walk into a bakery, a good analogy is, you smell that, what's going on, it smells good. But after a while, you just become adapted to that smell. It's no longer smelling good. It's like your homeostasis, if you will. It's just what you smell. So if you don't continually remind yourself of how good that smells, nothing's going to ever be good enough for you. I mean, like, that's why people have all these problems, where they're not grateful for anything. And then, like, you see, like, you know, like, that's why, like, a lot of, you know, really spoiled kids and stuff, they have problems because, like, nothing's ever good enough. Like, they're never going to be happy. So it's not being, like, not setting goals, being just happy with what you have. But you're generally going to actually get more, too. That's not, the goal is not to give, is to get. But the goal, when you're in a state of gratitude, you're in a state of receivership. So you're just kind of, your mind is more open to those things. So I'm not sure if it's just like a law of attraction thing, or if it's just like you're happen to be looking, like, because your mind is open and positive, it just kind of, like, you know, it's like things. If we start talking about certain kind of car, we go out driving, we're probably more likely to see that car. Like, I don't think we attracted it necessarily, but it's just now you're aware of it and you didn't think of it before. Like, my kids are obsessed with those Tesla Cybertrucks, and they're like, ever since they've been talking about them, we see those things everywhere. I never noticed them before. So I don't know if there's everybody around here bought them or what, but they're here. It seems like they're everywhere now.
Yeah, it's funny. And it's, yeah. As you said, there's so many important lessons there, but the framing is important. And, you know, there's always something to be grateful for, right? You can always find something. So I'm conscious of your time.
Right.
Can we quickly do the lightning round? And then, see.
Yep. Yeah, we got time. Let's go.
Does it sound all right? Okay.
Yep.
So answer can be as short or as long as you want, but generally short. So lifting first off, powerlifting versus strongman, which sport builds more overall strength?
Strongman for more functional.
What's one training method that you really like or you swear by that others don't think is good?
I would say rest pause training for upper body strength.
If you could only do one lift for the rest of your life, what would it be and why?
It would have to be like a farmer's walk or trap bar deadlift or something like that. I'd go with some kind of weighted carry. It'd have to be.
Yeah, I can see that. It makes a lot of sense. You've trained with some amazing people. So if you could only have one training partner, right, historical or current, who would it be?
I'll have to go with someone historical. I'll go with Kazmaier so that I don't hurt anybody's feelings.
What's your proudest personal lifting achievement?
Definitely my 810 deadlift, because I'm not built well to deadlift like I am to bench.
Interesting. So that actually meant more to you. That's cool.
Yeah, because I mean, it's one thing to be good at what you're good at. It's, you know, kind of boring to do. It's another thing to overcome, for sure.
The best piece of advice you could give someone early in their strength training journey?
I would say find somebody to learn from and learn from that person. Instead of trying to learn from, you know, 100 different people, you'd be better off almost like, if you're training for a fight, you would first learn, like, say, striking of some sort, like boxing. Then you venture into Muay Thai, then into grappling later on, versus like, I'm training MMA and, like, you know, you're striking one day. This, you learn from people, but make sure not to learn too much, because that's when you get crazy and, you know, you're a genius in training and then you're deadlifting your body weight kind of thing, just because it's driven you crazy.
And you've written a lot of books. I think roughly 27 or 28 from what
I
counted.
Yeah, it's 26. Then there's a couple of them that aren't on Amazon. They're like ISSA books, but yeah. So 28 maybe.
So we're pushing 30.
Right.
Outside your own books, what's your favorite book on strength training?
Anything by – I got to go to Ty. Any by Fred Hatfield or Charles Poliquin.
Okay, really cool. Yeah, I think I've read all of Charles's and most of Fred Hatfield's. So
yeah.
Last few, changing gears. How do you unwind after a long or stressful day?
For me, it's like, if you're working hard, I can just go. I can just unwind automatically. It's not hard to do at all. You know what I mean? It's just not like. I'm not one of those people that has to, like, you know, have a drink or, like, you know, have to meditate or something. I'm just, when I just know the day's over, just chill. Harder for me to get back up, but I could do it if I had to.
Who's had the most significant influence on your life, both personally and professionally?
I would say in strength training, it would be Fred Hatfield, and just like in life in general, my dad.
What's a life lesson you wish you learned earlier in your career?
I wish I would learn more about mindset earlier on. Like, I didn't realize it was a thing. Really, I mean, a lot of, like, the visualization and stuff for strength came naturally to me. So I didn't have to learn that. Like, mental movies and all that was just... But I didn't realize it was all this stuff for everything. And, like, learning self-talk. Like, I always had positive self-talk with sports. Like, I always thought I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof kind of thing. But not, like, in business and stuff. I didn't realize it. Like, I didn't realize saying stuff like, oh, I'm going to train at this gym and I just can't get, you know, as much as I should get what I'm worth. Cause I'd hear other people, like, I heard trainers like 50 years old talking that way when I'm like 20 something. And I didn't realize they had kind of a loser poverty mentality. I just thought, like, oh yeah, it sucks. We can't. It's like, dude, like, that's bullshit. You can't act like that. I didn't know so much until I started reading and learning on my own. I read a book called Psycho Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz, and that got the wheels turning majorly. And then I just started diving deep into this stuff. So I would say it's as important, assuming, like, on this business, I would say it's as important as actual training, because assuming you have a good coherent knowledge, just because if anything, it just helps you kind of like organize the stuff just by, like, I mean, I'm indecisiveness, like people trying to mix and mash programs where it's like, you know, it's always like the guy's like, oh, like I'm, you know, I got this Russian periodization scheme and like Boris Shako and, you know, whoever, Vladimir, whoever's cousin, and like, you know, cross with whatever. And then it like drives him crazy. He's like, this is, and then finally like, this is bullshit. What are you doing now? I'm training my garage with just a barbell and 5-3-1 making gains in my life. Yeah, because you actually have a plan now. You're sticking to it and you're progressively overloading it instead of just a bunch of minutia that, like, at the end of the day is just like, you never even did enough of the same stimulus to make an adaptation. It was just a freaking parking lot effect and made your mom go crazy.
Last two.
You
have kids, but
I got three.
What? Congratulations.
Yeah.
What one piece of advice that you would give to either 20-year-old Josh or to your son when he turns 20?
The advice already has been learn how to basically nobody's coming to save you. I didn't realize that either. I think that's you're going to have to learn how to do stuff yourself and not, you know what I mean? So tell them nobody's coming to save. I'll save you the best I can whenever I can, but you're going to have to learn how to handle yourself in business and all that. Like I say, in business and things like that, that's why I teach them a lot about that stuff, just because how everything's changing and the jobs and all that. I think you need to learn that kind of stuff, and you're not going to be able to depend on it's not like the old days where you just go, work at the same company for 30 years, retire with a golden watch and live off your pension, go to Florida once a year. The world's changing. And it could be the most exciting, great thing ever if you're ready for it, but it could be disaster too if you're not. Yeah. So you got to be ready for it.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.